Blog Talk Radio.
Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, July 29th, 2010. My name is Doug Kelly, and I'm here with Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, Doug.
Rubendunst man.
Oh, yeah. I'm here. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Wow.
It's Thursday night, man. It's almost the end of July already. Imagine that.
Can't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah. Here in Florida, it's been a pleasant, like, 95 degrees out.
It's been hot.
100% humidity. You betcha. Yeah.
It's been hot. So tonight we welcome back our Paranexus consultant David Roundtree, taking your questions on technology. He's going to also be discussing some experiments they've been doing with EVP, along with Dr. Ingrid Irwin, also board member, and some other cool stuff. Always an interesting fellow to talk to. David, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, always. Tonight, again, David will be taking your questions on technology and equipment, things of that nature, whatever. So please feel free to give us a call. Our own John Rossi will be screening your calls. Be nice to him.
Yes,
or not.
Or we will get out a big stick.
Yeah. Are you wish
John will. John has the power tonight.
Yeah.
So you can call us at the number there on your screen. You can ask questions in the chat room, but if you'd like to get in on it, we'd love to hear from you. So tonight, David, we're talking about technology, and while we wait for some questions to come forth, let's talk about the EVP stuff you've been doing along with Ingrid and Dale Huey,
Christian.
And Christian. Christian, I know, has been doing it. Christian's over in, where's he at, in Switzerland?
Sweden, I believe.
Sweden, that's right. He's in Sweden. Yeah. So, and he's really a fascinating guy, too. We need to get him on.
Yeah. Actually, Christian and I have been kind of conversing back and forth for about a year now. I was giving him some advice on building an EMF generator. Basically, what he was doing was taking a speaker and removing the cone and all the acoustical elements from it so that he was just broadcasting the EMF straight through the voice coil. And he was doing this to make like a beacon to see if he could attract any kind of, you know, EVP activity. But one of the things we got to was, you know, we've never really tested all these microphones to see how they reacted to electromagnetic fields. I mean, we had...
And you're talking about the different types of microphones, right?
Right, right. Which we had postulated about it, you know, but we had never actually proved anything. We had looked at the actual circuitry design and how the elements work and that sort of thing. And
what
we
types
speculated
of...
that, well, for example, you in broadcasting, we use condenser microphones. And condenser microphones, we know, are not affected by electromagnetic fields because they work off changes in capacitance. In other words, acoustic energy will hit the diaphragm, and it actually moves two plates inside the microphone, which alters the capacitance between those two plates, and that's how it actually records sound. EMF doesn't affect it at all. But we got to talking about electret microphones, which are the most common microphone found in these little pocket portable digital recorders and, you know, these things that everyone's getting EVPs on. And I had theorized that it is possible that they could pick up EMF because they utilize the polarized element. So we decided that we were going to test this stuff and see just how sensitive to EMF it was. And not only were we going to test the microphones, we were going to test the cabling and the wire and actually the devices themselves to see, you know, how well they responded to electromagnetic fields. And we had some very interesting discoveries while doing this. What we actually found out was that electret microphones, because they are powered by a voltage, generally anywhere from 5 to 12 volts, they do not react directly to electromagnetic fields that are beneath that voltage threshold.
All right, so let's just stop for just a second and kind of recap. So we're talking about electric condenser microphones that require a voltage, and these are the ones that are placed commonly in digital recorders and so forth?
I don't know if you can hear me, but I cannot hear you.
Oh, you
so
can
I'm
hear,
going to hang up, and you guys can try to call me back.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Don't you hate that commercial? Can you hear me now? All right, let's see if we can get David back. And there's one ringy dingy.
Hello?
Hey, can you hear us now?
Yeah. Man, that was weird. Y'all just went dead.
Oh, we could hear you, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You didn't hear all those things Grant was saying about you, did you?
No, I didn't
Don't
hear
tell
a
him.
Thing.
Don't tell him. Come on.
I didn't hear a thing. Where were we now? Let's see.
I wanted to hold on 1 second.
Sure.
I think there was a glitch in the whole system because some are saying how they can't hear any longer. Let me check some different things. I think there was a Skype glitch because we didn't get dropped, Grant and I, in Blog Talk, but John did.
True.
John got dropped off, so
well,
have him.
Skype gods are angry with us again tonight for some unknown reason.
Well, it was probably your fault. You probably
I thought you were playing on the Ouija board again. You
no.
know, that's usually what happens. But, you know, here in Florida, we've had electrical storms pretty much all day, so maybe that had something to do with it. Who knows?
Yeah.
Ghost in the machine, guys.
Yeah, electrical energy in the air does weird stuff. So,
what I wanted to sum up. So we're talking about electric condenser microphones, which require voltage. And these are the ones that you're saying are commonly used in digital recorders, correct?
Actually, electret microphones. They're kind of a hybrid microphone where they have, it's kind of like a capacitor microphone, only they use the polarized element so that it actually does respond to polarization.
So it's not electric condenser, it's electret. I made it sound like I said electric. I meant electric.
Yeah, it's electret. Electret microphone,
right.
Yeah.
Right, so are they using electric condenser mics in these digital audio recorders?
Yeah, they are. I mean, that's the mic that comes with it, which is why I've always preached, you know, to use an external dynamic microphone when you're looking for EVPs. But the thing that made it so interesting is we have so many of these people using these cheap little recorders claiming that they're getting, you know, EVPs. And, you know, a lot of the people making claims are not, you know, hobbyists. They're people that are doing research. Although these recorders do generate a tremendous amount of artifacts in the recording, which is why we quit using them a while back. But
are you talking about the separate additional microphone that you can plug into them, or are you talking about the built-in microphone?
No, we're talking about using a separate external microphone.
The one that comes with many of these digital recorders, correct?
No, we don't use those at all. We actually go and we purchase a dynamic microphone that, and really it doesn't even matter how good a quality it is. As long as it's a dynamic microphone, it works, you know, scads better.
Let's back up for just a second. You said that these mics that come with the digital recorders have a lot of artifacts.
It's right? The recorder has a lot of artifacts.
Okay, so it's the built-in microphone in the recorder you're talking about.
Right, but the recorders themselves, like I'm talking about like the little Sonys, the little, what's the other one that's really used a lot? I can't think of it. They're really cheap.
Olympus.
The Olympus device itself, the recorder itself, actually adds a lot of artifacts to the recording.
Huh.
And we've discovered this over a long period of time, which is frankly why we pretty much moved up to like digital near studio quality recorders like the Tascam R7s and that sort of thing, because it's a much better platform to do the recording on, whether you're using, you know, external mics or mixers or however you're using it to, because it's a almost broadcast or recording quality type of recorder.
The Zoom mic or Zoom recorder, that's a good
one. Right, yeah, like same thing. You know, because the thing is you're wanting to, those other recorders are basically voice recorders. They're for like dictation or for like, you know, taking records of a meeting or something. They're not really designed for high fidelity or for full frequency response. So you run into a lot of intelligibility problems sometimes when you're dealing with an EVP that's very close to the noise floor. So, but anyway, we're kind of straying a little bit.
Sure, go ahead. That's good stuff, though.
Yeah, it is. It's very important. The thing that we found out, though, was in order for an Electret microphone to be responsive, the signal had to be hotter than the supply voltage to get over that supply voltage. The supply voltage acts kind of like a wall that shields it. And these little recorders, it's a 5-volt supply, or in the little ones that use these penlight batteries, it's a 3-volt supply that actually powers the batteries. So unless something gets over that 3-volt threshold, you're not going to record it. So that was an interesting find.
And so we're talking, and let's keep it, you know, get it into lay terms as well. So
yeah.
We're still talking about which mics or which recorders, rather.
We're basically right now we're talking about the Olympus type handhelds. And if you're using the built-in mic, the only way you're going to get any EVP is if the EVP is actually at a higher level than the supply voltage going to the microphone is. And that's why some people do get some EVPs with these devices, because they're strong enough to where they're getting over that supply voltage, 3 volts, which I thought was kind of an interesting thing to find out. So.
Yeah, I mean, there must be a little bit of power to them.
Yeah, so.
Energy to them.
So this is another reason why you should use a dynamic mic, though, because think of all the things you're missing that are below that 3-volt threshold. So that was kind of a reinforcement for using a dynamic microphone, external microphone, and using these recorders.
Good point.
And then the other thing that we did is we did an experiment with actual perception where we made utterances. Christian made a series of sound bites. And he kind of played a trick on us as well, too. And I'm not going to get into too much of the details because we don't have all the responses back yet. But essentially, we made a bunch of sound files. Some of them were very intelligible, and some of them were trying to duplicate some of the effects of an EVP. And we sent them out, and the responses so far have been pretty interesting. And what that's going to do is kind of show how human response figures into the equation, you know, how we hear what we want to hear, or how accurate is our hearing when we're analyzing these things we think we hear or that we do hear. So that's something that we hadn't really done, and we wanted to get a good feel for just how much of an effect that really is. So we'll have that information compiled probably in another couple of weeks. But
cool.
That's looking pretty interesting, too, because different people hear different things. I mean, it's that simple. And when you have a controlled experiment, and essentially it's kind of like being done on a double-blind situation where no one really knows what the files is except for the person who generated them and sent the test out. So it's kind of interesting.
Cool. So what other technology you've been working with or been...
Well, I've been kicking around this whole wormhole thing, and I've been refining the device that I've been building to try to monitor that and adding additional sensing equipment to it. And over 4th of July weekend, I actually did a repeat investigation where I'd had these two occurrences occur in the past, and I, sure enough, around 9 o'clock at night, I had a repeat performance there. And we noticed something different. We noticed that in addition to all the other things that are occurring, we were getting gravity shifts, which throws a whole new spin on the whole...
Talk about that a little bit and explain, because I know we talked a little bit about it on the last time you were on, but let's refresh people's minds on what you're trying to do and accomplish and
what this means. Yeah, what we had noticed is that EVPs tend to just like appear like in the center of a room from no identifiable source. So we thought it would kind of be interesting to try to pinpoint the exact location where the EVP appeared, actually propagated into the room. And what we did was we created this kind of a triangulation device where we use these detection coils, which are a whole lot like a radio detection finder used to be like in the 40s, where we mount these up in three positions to triangulate the center of a room. And then when we start to get EVP, the coils actually pick up the EMF that's the source of the EVP, and we're able to place its actual location roughly in the room by looking at the different field strengths on the three different coils. And it's an approximation, but the area of effect is big enough to where we get pretty close to where it's actually going on. So that was like the first step of the experiment, was to physically locate where the stuff was coming from. So once we knew that that part of it worked, we started saying, okay, when it does appear, let's load up all of our detection equipment in that area and see what changes are actually going on in the environment where this is occurring. And we did that, and we found that the environment was changing pretty dramatically where this effect was occurring in the room. And we noticed, for example, that we were getting gamma radiation bursts. We were getting dramatic increases in static electricity, magnetic fields, EMF. Very low-frequency EMF was appearing, like 2 or 3 hertz standing waves were coming out of nowhere. Temperature changes were occurring. We were getting dramatic drops in barometric pressure, dramatic increases in ionization. Ion counts skyrocketed. the whole gamut, and time slips were occurring. I mean, just all kinds of weirdness was going on in this very localized area of a room.
How big was the isolated area, David?
About 2 meters, and it varies somewhat in size.
Big. That is very big. That's big. When you talk about the gravity shift, was there anything that indicated that might be going on there too? Was that part of the mix?
Well, that was the latest piece of equipment that we added to the mix over the July 4th weekend. We actually had a data logger hooked up that was actually measuring gravity, G-force on three axes. And we were actually seeing where the gravity was varying from like 1G. Sometimes it would go up to 1.2 Gs. Sometimes it would go down to 0.84 Gs. It was fluctuating just in that area, whereas the areas immediately outside of the area of effect had no effect whatsoever.
Was it fluctuating gradually or rapidly? I'm just kind of curious.
It was like swings. I mean, there were things that was like, it was like a wavering type of effect. And the other data was kind of holding the same frequency of occurrences. In other words, there's a very low frequency EMF that occurs, like I say, between 2 and 4 hertz, and the data was actually oscillating at that 2 or 4 hertz rate.
Do you think that the interaction of the fields, David, can either augment or, take away from the quality of the EVP?
No, sure, because you've got phasing differentials. If you have a frequency that's out of phase with what you're trying to capture, there's going to be some cancellation. There's going to be, all kinds of things. And additionally, if you've got frequencies that are in sync with these frequencies, you can actually get where
harmonics, harmonic effect.
That, and plus you can get an amplification of it, actually. You can actually have an additive effect if it's in phase and it's the right frequency, group of frequencies that are adding to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an accumulative effect as well as a degradation effect, depending on the nature of the interference that is introduced into the environment. So, but yeah, absolutely it affects it.
Here's a question from the chat room. Have you used a FLIR camera to video these events?
It's interesting. We've been using a video camera, but when these events occur, because we're so close to the field of effect, for some reason it blanks out the camera.
Huh.
So what we're going to do in the future is we're actually going to set some cameras up outside of the field of effect to see if they're affected by what's going on.
Because yeah,
apparently what's happening is the actual CMOS chip in the camera is being interfered with by these frequencies.
So to sum it up, what's your goal here, your objective in doing this research?
Well, what we're trying to do is to find a source for paranormal activity. I mean, what is facilitating it? I mean, we don't know really what it is yet, although we can measure effects that it's having on the environment. So what we want to do is to identify the mechanics of how it occurs. And the evidence right now points very strongly towards a type of momentary wormhole opening. And I'm developing a whole wormhole theory based on this data that we're collecting that I'm going to write a paper on here before long. But we think a portal actually forms and opens up, and this facilitates this traffic coming into our environment that we are seeing. About 90% of what we're seeing, between 75% and 90% of what we see, isn't paranormal at all, but the actual effect of the conduits opening up in the environment and how it's affecting the environment. And then, you know, the 10 to 25% that's remaining is the actual what we're calling paranormal activity.
So some of these spikes that people might be measuring might actually just be...
It might be the effect of the conduit opening up.
Right, not the entities, presumably.
Right, and what makes it so difficult is when you're using a meter, you have no idea what the frequency of that spike is. You just know that the intensity is there. So you have really no way of identifying what it is. You're just getting a spike. Where we're actually mapping what those frequencies are that are making the spikes.
Yeah,
so we're getting a pretty good idea of really what's going on in the environment, what is really natural in the environment and what is unnatural in the environment.
Have you gotten to the stage, David, where you are you contemplating seeing what the effect of human voice is on that wormhole when it opens up?
Actually, what we're doing is we're going to plan to do a EMF bombardment using a signal generator so that we can vary the frequency that we focus on it.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to see if EMF actually has any effect on it, a focused
uh-huh.
EMF beam. If we propagate our own low frequencies towards it, the idea is to try to figure out a way to either make the effect last longer, actually instigate the effect on our own,
keep the or to, open.
Or to force uh-huh. it to close or to have any effect whatsoever. You know, we want to learn what's doing it. And right now we think EMF is probably the biggest formula for success with doing that, since it seems to be an EMF-based phenomena to begin with.
Are there particular frequencies that you're picking up that are more common than others?
Yeah, we actually have, there's like a low frequency, what I call a carrier, that comes through first before anything comes through. And amazingly, it's kind of in the same range that the carrier that we picked up when we were doing our medium experiments, where we were monitoring what was going on when a medium was doing her thing.
What frequency range?
It's very, very low frequency. Like we're looking between 2 and 8 hertz is where these frequencies occur.
Oh.
And then we have a series of frequencies we call brainwave frequencies, which are actually waves that emulate brainwaves. They actually look like some form of alpha, beta, theta, you know, type of brainwave activity, and looks very near similar to brainwave waveforms that you would find on any kind of a CAT scan or that sort of thing. So,
David, when the wormhole starts to form, do you get any visuals? The cameras picked up any visual, like color changes or wavering?
Well,
I think I asked that question before, but...
Yeah, interestingly, we have bursts of ultraviolet light, and it's very high-frequency ultraviolet light down in the 260 nanometer and below range. So, yeah, we're getting bursts of light, which we think has something to do with an energy discharge of some type. But visually, sometimes we'll see like a wavering, like you'll see on a hot road on a very hot day when you look off in the distance. You'll see like a wavering effect, almost like a mirage or something is forming. And we think that's due to the high level of ionization that's occurring in the atmosphere. It's actually causing it to heat up, almost like it's creating a mirage effect. Additionally, there's been other things like telekinesis type effects where objects have moved, like in what really first got me onto this, the very first experience I had was a salt shaker, a heavy pewter salt shaker moved across the table. And I thought maybe it was being moved by the super low frequency if it was at a proper amplitude. But the frequencies weren't at an amplitude, you know, strong enough or sufficient enough to move that kind of weight. So something else was in play there that we weren't measuring. And there's a lot of things that are in play here that we are measuring because we have no idea what they are. But we're starting to narrow in on things because we're starting to focus on what we do know, and then we're starting to flesh those out. And in the process of doing that, we're discovering more things to look at. So it's like the proverbial Pandora's box. I mean, the more we open it up, the more stuff flies out of it. So as soon as we answer one question, we've created five more that need answering. So it's kind of an interesting ride right now.
All right, and to our listeners out there, if you have a question for David on equipment or anything we're talking about here, feel free to give us a call. You can also ask in the chat room. We've got a couple questions to go over yet, but give us a call. The numbers are on your screen, or you can use that click-to-talk button if you have a headset on your computer. One of the questions that I need to get to here is this frequency surge you were talking about. The question is this the pop or the crack that frequently precedes an EVP?
Yeah, we think this is a precursor. We think this is conducive to what people have reported as hearing a thud or a thump or a snap or a crack prior to, you know, some attention-getting noise that actually focuses them on a spot where they actually do get EVP. And what I think is happening is because there's air pressure differentials between these conduits and our own reality or universe, I think there's actually a sucking in effect that occurs, which creates this drop in atmospheric pressure. And they're hearing that audible pop of the air being sucked up into the funnel, into the event horizon of the opening wormhole.
Have you ever measured if there's any kind of atmospheric change? In terms of pressure?
Yeah, the air pressure, the atmospheric pressure actually dropped significantly. The last drop that we noticed went from, I've got it right here somewhere. Hold on a second. Yeah, we went from 29.2 to 28.8, which is a pretty significant drop for a 2-meter area in a room where outside of that area was the normal base reading. So there's definitely something very localized that's occurring in that spot. And if you happen to be within that event horizon, then you're going to be picking up EVPs. You're going to be picking up, you know, all sorts of things and probably experiencing all sorts of things based on your proximity to that locality. So, and it's very localized, and it's very transitory. I mean, these effects have lasted as long as 2 minutes that we've observed and as short as 3 or 4 seconds. So it's kind of an on-again, off-again thing, and it's just pure damn luck if you get there in the right place with the equipment.
Yeah.
But we've been fortunate enough to have 3 instances now that we've been able to document. So.
Well, I think most physicists, you know, I think believe that, you know, I think probably mainstream, that if you open something like that, it closes right away, don't they? Isn't that the current trend?
Well, because
of the energy and everything else that's required supposedly to open a wormhole.
Right. See, the theory is now that most physicists believe that wormholes open and close around us millions and millions of times a day, but at the Planck level.
Uh-huh.
And that being, you know, like multi-microscopic and conditioning. What's important about this is it may actually be the first evidence of a macro wormhole opening that's been recorded. And, I mean, we're not quite ready yet to jump to that conclusion, but, boy, it sure looks very tempting. Right.
But
I mean,
David, haven't the Chinese or somebody else been experimenting and they've been doing with sound frequencies where they can actually create a vortex-like black hole. Are you familiar with the work they've been doing?
Yeah, they've been doing that. They've been doing that with using very high energy acoustics,
uh-huh,
and actually creating air turbulence. And the thing is that with the Chinese, I mean, they don't publish full details of what they do, so it's very difficult to replicate some of the stuff that they claim. I find what I've read about it very interesting, and I think it lends a lot of credence to the work that we're doing. They're just using mechanical energy, and we're using electrical energy.
But there's a similarity there.
But there's a very close similarity, as there should be.
Mm-hmm.
Energy is energy is energy, regardless of the form it takes, whether it's mechanical, acoustical, or electrical, or magnetical, or however you want to do it. Energy is energy is energy, and it all behaves in very similar manners. It just manifests a little different based on the medium in which it's operating in. So in their case, they're dealing with something that's very down to earth. They're using air as their propagating medium, and it makes a whole lot of sense what they're claiming. I just wished I could see more of the detail of the actual experimentation that they're doing.
So if we could just digress for a second, if wormholes on the Planck level, as you said, are opening constantly, opening, closing, maybe what you guys are working on, maybe somehow to put it in a, it's like rounding up those little wormholes. And, you know, you got them lassoed, and for a few seconds, they're all in sync.
Well, it only takes two strings to do this.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of research going on right now about something that's called the supercosmic string. And these are strings that are left over from the Big Bang that can be huge. I mean, light years long. We're not looking for something light years long. We're looking for something that may only be a few thousand feet long. And the other thing that we're finding is these are two-way portals. So it's not a single wormhole. It's actually a dual wormhole that's opening. And the theory that I'm developing is that it's a double helix that forms. And what actually happens is two strings approach each other. I mean, have you ever been into like a music store where they have guitars like hanging on the wall? Have you ever taken an acoustic guitar and plucked it? Like just pluck one string and then listen to all the guitars in the store start vibrating at that same frequency.
Resonating with it, yep. Uh-huh.
Yep. Well, see, what my theory is as two strings approach each other, they start to resonate at a common frequency. And as they resonate, they intertwine. And once they fully intertwine, they hit resonance so that they're both vibrating at exactly the same frequency. And when this occurs, they intermix with exotic matter, which I think is the medium between, if we had parallel universes, the spatial area between those universes are going to be made up of exotic matter. It's the only thing that will buffer the universes and keep them from touching each other or creating interference with each other.
Canceling each other out.
Right. So what happens is as these wormholes form, they gather a sufficient amount of exotic matter to stabilize them. Once they stabilize, they make a connection. Boom. The funnels hit one universe, they hit the other universe, and boom, information passes in either direction. And once these annihilations begin occurring, when the exotic matter hits our matter, that's when we start getting the gamma radiation bursts. And eventually, the exotic matter is annihilated, and the wormhole collapses.
So presumably, the connection would be between our reality, our universe, and presumably wherever spirits
a parallel
are.
Universe. Or it could be another part of our universe. I mean, I particularly am thinking right now, though, that we're looking at between two universes. But it could also theoretically happen within a universe from one point to another. And interestingly, how this theory affects UFO researchers is these wormholes that are inside our universe may actually be a conduit of travel, which would allow interstellar travel without breaking the speed of light or affecting any of the laws of physics. Literally,
right. So
you could open a wormhole and you could literally travel in a couple of hours 200 million light years.
and then be back home for lunch.
Exactly.
That's Star Trek.
Yeah, if you made a double helix to where you had a return path attached to your path getting there, you would have a way to go back that was attached to the way you came. And because these two things would be tied to each other and actually in resonance, they wouldn't be violating any of the laws of energy as far as, you know, energy conservation or any of that thing. They would actually be supporting each other.
So you wouldn't come out on an alternative timeline or in the future, in the past, or whatever. Probably interesting stuff. Very interesting.
Yeah, the path would be very stable to whatever the destination was and whatever the destination point from where it came from. So it would be a very stable conduit while it lasted. So it's kind of an interesting thing that would explain a lot of things. It may explain why no one's ever found a Bigfoot, because maybe they're inter-universal creatures. You know, you don't know. I mean, it's definitely the paranormal field is interconnected by a lot of things. We deal with a lot of similar data when we're investigating what we investigate.
Right.
And there's a lot of commonalities. As different as they all are, there are commonalities that run through all of these various fields of the unknown. And it would be kind of neat and tidy if we did find something that would explain most of it as far as a source point.
The paranormal theory of everything.
Yeah.
Kind of
what it would be. I mean, I don't dream that that would ever be the case. I'm just looking at a small piece of the pie. But the potential's there for it. I mean, it could potentially very well be the universal conduit for all of this stuff entering into our universe or entering into our awareness even. So, I mean, it's certainly an important thing to be chasing down. And feel like right now that's where most of our resources are going into right now, is trying to prove this thing one way or the other that this is actually a wormhole. And, of course, if it is and we do it, we're going to be hugely famous, because it's going to be a huge physics discovery. Just not even to think about the paranormal aspect of it, just the physics aspect alone would be huge. So,
well, you know, and it is it's a good hypothesis for explaining a number of different things, including ghosts, Bigfoot, even some UFO sightings.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I mean, heck, we can even take it to abductions.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's just one of those things, and that's what we felt for a long time, that there are overlaps, that this stuff is all really the same thing, only different.
Yep, absolutely. And I mean, it makes sense. I mean, it's a theory that actually makes sense. It's founded solidly in science.
Yeah.
And if we do discover a wormhole on a macro level, or a wormhole at all, it'll be huge, because they're all theoretical at this point. So if we can actually map one, it will be huge.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And let me ask you a question from Sharon that she posted a little bit ago on a little bit of a different topic.
Yeah, I'm ready. She asked me already, so I'm ready.
Okay, so her question is about residual hauntings. What can you tell us about how that can be imprinted upon matter and the dynamics of what triggers it? So basically, how can it be?
Yeah. As I alluded to before, I don't really believe that we imprint this stuff on matter. I mean, a lot of people use the argument that it could be the holographic effect and all these things, but I think what the reality is, we are actually sitting in an event horizon, and while we are not back in time, we are able to glimpse a moment in time and not fully experience it, but witness it. And what happens is we enter into this event horizon where we are kind of in a cusp. We're like, half of us is in the world that we know and love and live in, and half of us is gazing into a world just like ours that was from 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And it's just for a moment. We just get these momentary glimpses. For example, people at Gettysburg seeing an entire Union Army marching across the field, and then they just vanish right in front of their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I had two friends of mine that are reenactors. They were camping one night, and this whole company of Confederate soldiers marched past, and so they got in line and marched with them, and suddenly they all vaporized around them, and they weren't there anymore. And they were in the bar for 2 days after that. they were shaken.
Incredibly. Well, I recall another incident like that where I think there were people that were from Europe were over there, and I don't know how documented it is. Maybe it's just an anecdotal story, but where they saw people out there doing maneuvers like they used to do in the
there were some people that witnessed the D-Day invasion in 1991, I think it was. that wow. they witnessed the entire thing, and it scared them to death. They thought it was like some incredible thing going on, and they actually heard the sounds, saw the aircraft, saw people dying, being shot, and then it just vaporized. It was gone.
Well, you know, there's an account, too, over in England where people hear the sound of an aircraft approaching, you know. And it passes over, and they could swear that, you know, it sounds just like, you know, a World War II vintage bomber.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask.
I think what it is we're actually witnessing a part of the past. We're witnessing a moment in the past through a time anomaly that's associated with these conduits.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another question from the chat room. What are your experiences working with an EMF pump?
I think it's the most ludicrous thing I've ever seen or looked at in my life.
Does it have a handle,
too? Yeah, I mean, first of all, what frequency of EMF does it generate? That's the first question you have to ask. I mean, does anyone know what frequency it generates? No. And chances are it's probably generating 60 cycles. So you're just as well to sit there with a very high-intensity light bulb and turn it on and stand near it. You'll be getting the same effect. EMF pumps really, first of all, in order to influence the environment with EMF, you need an extraordinary amount of energy. Extraordinary amount of energy. And it's not something you can get plugging into the wall. It would be something like using a 400-amp three-phase service to generate. So I think that, you know, a lot of people are making a lot of money off people's gullibility on some of this stuff.
All right, we have a caller on the line, Stephen Rourke. Welcome, Stephen. You're on the air, Stephen. Welcome.
Is it actually Stephen Rourke, David?
Yeah, it's actually Stephen Rourke.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying that because
way too much. So.
Yeah. See, I've downloaded the podcast here, actually, on occasion, and I know that they have some trouble with prank callers, so I made it very clear. I said, yes, I'm the co-host with David's Devil's Advocate podcast. And they didn't give me too much trouble getting through, but
well, I'm gonna have to talk to John about that next time. John,
yeah,
who the hell you let on?
Yeah,
exactly. So someone were following David's every move. They could have easily persuaded him that they too were Stephen Rourke.
Yeah, I feel like I'm being stalked for some reason here.
Well, it's more like a campfire, and I was calling because, as usual, I like listening to you talk a lot more than myself, so I thought maybe you could put in layman's terms what you've been, the info bombs you've been dropping on the Yahoo group. I found that email that you had linked me into that Yahoo group. I found that amazing.
My theory?
The way you're integrating supergravity theories, and of course how you succinctly integrate string theory with both open strings, and how the two types of strings behave. And it might be too much in the minutes remaining, but I thought that was a mind blower. It probably deserves an entire show. You've just got a great way of integrating all of the latest cutting-edge physics. So I just thought I'd call up and say that, and now I'm going to hang up so I can listen more.
Cool. Thanks for calling, Stephen.
Bye.
Thanks for dropping that egg.
Yeah.
I'm a member of a Yahoo group called Theoretical Physics, and it's, you know, a group of us get together, and we hash out all these life, the universe, and everything kind of questions in physics and stuff, and I had been questioning them as to what the root cause could have been for some of these gravity fluctuations, and they kept pressuring me for why I wanted, what was I doing, what was going on, so I kind of like wrote up a kind of brief synopsis of my theory that I was developing on the whole wormhole thing. But the key to the whole thing is that it's like I pretty much explained it, it's these strings approaching and then resonating with each other and intertwining, and that forming the basis of a double helix wormhole. So, I mean, I could go into a lot more greater detail with supergravity theories and stuff, but, you know, it's not easy to put the stuff in lay terms right now, and I'm going to really attempt to write a paper on it here before long. But seriously, the whole thing, really, there's nothing in physics that violates what I'm explaining right now. I mean, there's nothing that precludes it. There's nothing that outlaws it. I mean, everything that I'm doing is based on very sound and solid physics theories and findings. And I think a good lesson for us all to take up from this is that if we do want to be taken seriously in our research, that we need to base it in these kind of foundations to present it to the public.
Well, that makes sense.
And then maybe we'll get some, you know, additional researchers that will whet their curiosity and putting some resources into trying to find some of these answers as well.
And, you know, I think the other important thing to remember, too, is that, you know, the state of the science is changing. It's changing.
Daily.
Yes.
Daily.
And that, you know, what was a paradigm yesterday is gone today on a lot of things.
Let me give you a sample of this. For example, Fermilab, which is our big particle accelerator, we have narrowed down the actual mass that the Higgs boson can exist at. Literally. We have eliminated everything but a small band of mass ratios where the particle can actually exist, which means they are days from actually finding it if it's real. Days.
So if we find the God particle, what are the implications?
Well, that's kind of a large question, because the Higgs boson theory, the whole aspect of it, deals with really, literally, life, the universe, and everything. It actually will bring about evidence supporting the Big Bang. It may create the final link into linking gravity and the other major energy sources or powers or forces of the universe.
So we truly have a unified theory that Einstein and people have been searching for a long time?
It will be the key to the theory of everything. Everything will fall into place around that. I mean, it's not going to happen right away, but that's like the trowel and the mortar. So if we can actually find that, then what that means is that the subatomic particle table will be complete from Big Bang to current reality. And what that really means is it's like, you know, you're digging up some old bones on an archaeological dig or on a paleontology dig or what have you, and you find a Tyrannosaurus rex and you're looking for that last eye tooth. Well, the Higgs boson is that last eye tooth that makes the skeleton complete.
Huh.
So, I mean, it's huge. I mean, if they find it, it's huge. Because if they can observe Higgs boson, they're going to fill in all the blanks or most of the blanks that they have in particle physics.
And Fermilabs is doing that.
No. Yeah, they're killing CERN, man.
Yeah.
They're killing CERN. So I find it fascinating because they've been battling each other now for ever since CERN came online, because Fermilab like went into overdrive when they went live at CERN. So and there was actually a rumor circulating last week, I think it was on the net, that they had actually found Higgs boson, and I'd made the statement in the lab or in the Yahoo group that I'm in, I said if they found it, I said they wouldn't announce it until they had duplicated it several times, because they're not going to announce something like that and find out it's an artifact afterwards.
Well, that, so doesn't I, that also, if they have the unified theory, doesn't that like, and you know, I could be, I you know, I'm not the physicist here, but doesn't that also support supersymmetry as well?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, everything falls into place. It's mm-hmm. just like. It's like you're building something with Legos, and you can't make it stand up until you put that one little green foot on the bottom of it. And it's that one little green foot that we're dealing with here. And literally, a lot of physics will fall into place if they find the God particle, because they're actually going to see something from the moment of creation.
Wow.
And that's what it's all about. I mean, where it began.
Mm-hmm.
So it's huge. But... you know, we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I believe it's going to. If I believe they're either going to discover it or they're going to discover it doesn't exist within probably this year at some point.
And in the event that it doesn't exist, then it means maybe lot of our theories are completely wrong.
Well, what it's going to mean is there's going to be a new theory called the Higgs boson effect. In other words, they're going to put a force to it instead of a particle to it. Because there are definitely aspects of Higgs boson that exist and that have been documented, which is what turned them on to it being in existence in the first place, or starting them to look for it, because there are effects that are attributed to the Higgs boson particle, and these effects have been noted. So if it's not a particle, then it's an effect, and then the race will be for what causes the effect. So,
well, I have something to do.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that they'll find Higgs boson, though. I mean, I really do.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, it'll take another 50 years to document everything once everything falls in place. Because they'll have to test, retest, experiment, re-experiment, reconfirm, and build the whole case. But at least they'll have a blueprint then. So, but we live in fascinating times, gentlemen. Fascinating.
Yeah,
times.
There's no doubt about that.
I mean, daily I read where there's a new discovery. And it's just, particularly in physics, and it's just got me on the edge of my seat, because every day when I start to read all the things that I read every day, I'm wondering what I'm going to have to change in my own protocols to adapt to what we've learned in the last 24 hours. So
the whole everything shifts. You know, you start out working on something at 9 o'clock in the morning. By 4, everything's shifted.
Yep, that's
I mean,
exactly
that's an
right.
Exaggeration, but you know,
you think you have a new. You think you have a new paradigm, only 4 hours later to discover you don't.
yeah.
You know, I get the sense.
Excuse me.
I, and this is just a sense, and I could be wrong, but I get the sense of the last 10 or 15 years perhaps will be looked back upon as a great time of discovery. In
I do too.
Quantum
do
physics,
too.
Cosmology. And
I think we are living in a quantum leap. Period.
That's
history.
A good way to put it.
I
really
do. I get
the sense that we are.
And I think probably within the next 15 years, you're going to see huge things come out of science, huge things.
Well, you know, the thing that's so wonderful about it, too, is just when we think sometimes that we're getting there, the universe throws us a curve.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know, it throws us this, and it's almost like, you know what, you almost, I mean, without sounding a little out there, it's almost like you got to keep working because you're not there yet. You know, keep right. going, keep going, keep going. Because it's almost like it's almost like it's ever changing.
Yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
It is
dynamic.
Yeah, that's a better word. Thank you.
It is dynamic, and it's such a roller coaster ride too. I mean, 20 years ago, I would look at these things, and physics was like solid as a rock. You know what I'm saying? You went into school, you went into college, physics was like old hat. There were no surprises. Now physics is like on the blackboard, and the equation changes daily. You know, an exponent here, a derivative there, it changes daily. And it is terraforming into something far bigger than it began. And it's really an exciting time. It really is. I mean, I'm glad I'm alive today to see what's going on. Because 20 years ago, if you would have told me that I would see the sort of things I'm seeing now, I would have laughed at your face and said, you're watching too much television.
There's
oh, absolutely.
There's a question in the chat room. Do you think wormholes already exist, or can they be created? I know we've talked about that. If you want to give a quick answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think they come and go. I think they have a quantum effect. I think they pop into existence. I think when the conditions that allow them to exist exhaust, they pop out again and then they reform. I think there are probably areas of the Earth where there are consistent, very large areas of wormhole activity. I think a place that would come to everybody's mind would be, and I'm sure everyone thinks this, the Bermuda Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be a great deal of wormhole activity occurring in the Bermuda Triangle. Certainly it would explain a lot of things, aside from even the disappearances, just some of the effects that are occurring to people's aircraft with their instrumentation and that sort of thing. So I think, yeah, it's very possible that we have areas on the Earth where these things pop in and out all the time at regular intervals. I think what we're dealing with at the paranormal stage of looking for explanations for why houses are claimed to be haunted, I think that these do appear on a, reoccur. To call it a regular basis would probably be inaccurate, but they reoccur over a period of time sometimes with no rhyme or reason, but they do seem to reoccur in the same general area over and over again. They don't last for very long, but they have an intensive amount of effect that comes with them. And it's to the point where it's measurable, and you can document the changes that are occurring in the environment. So I also believe that it may be possible to artificially open one. Like we were talking about earlier, I think, you know, we're going to start playing around with using high-energy EMF to attempt to open one of these things up or to influence it once it's occurring. And see what happens. I mean, it's a crapshoot. We have no idea what we're going to do. I mean, if, you know, I suddenly disappear off the face of the earth in a couple of weeks, you'll know what happened. But
in through the wormhole.
I mean, we just don't know. We don't know what will happen.
Now to just move into a different area a little bit, are there weapons applications for this kind of technology?
I think travel would be an implication to actually use it as some kind of a weapon. It would be like, you know, can you use a cardboard tube as a weapon? You know, I guess you could, but what could you do with it, you know? I mean, it would more of a be a good way to move a whole lot of stuff a long ways really quick. So strategically, it would be a good support thing for a weapon or for warfare, but to actually use it as a weapon, I don't think it in and of itself could be much of a weapon more than it is a method of transportation.
But for logistics, it may be more practical. The reason why I asked, Dave, was just basically, you know, if there's always, and I know you guys both know where I'm going with this. If there's
you can get funding if you can kill somebody with
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going now. So, I mean, if you guys are working on this now, it makes me think that somebody else is working on it, and they're doing it clandestinely.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to think somebody was working on it. I mean, I really would like to think somebody with more resources than I have was working on it. But, I mean, the practical aspect of it would be, of course, travel. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
If you knew where the other end went, you know, it would be a great way to move materials, to transport, to whatever. So I think over the long run, the practical control of this sort of thing would be a huge, huge step for mankind as far as exploring the universe and beyond.
All right, we're down to the last couple of minutes or so. David, you want to give everybody your website?
Yeah, it's real easy to find. It's www.spinvestigations, S-P-I-N-vestigations, just like the word investigations, .org. We have our podcast there where Dr. Rourke and I pretty much talk about everything under the sun, and no one is sacred.
I love it.
And we pretty much call it like we see it there. We've been on a brief hiatus because Dr. Rourke was traveling abroad, and I'm got my hands knee-deep in all kinds of hoopla here. So, feel free to come in, drop us emails, ask us questions. We're happy to address. I mean, I answer everybody I can to the best of my knowledge.
All right, so we've been talking with David Roundtree, Pernix consultant, researcher, and all kinds of things, huh, David?
Yeah, well, it's always that way.
Yeah, and that's some interesting stuff we've talked about tonight. So if you didn't catch the entire program, be sure and listen back to the archive. We appreciate everybody listening to us tonight and joining us in the chat room. We appreciate your questions. Next week, we will welcome back Morgan Bell. He will be talking about his investigations in ufology here in the Florida area. I know he's investigated some interesting things.
Morgan's a friend of ours. We've known him for a while, and we've done some work with him, done some investigations, so that'll be great.
Yeah, so we'll welcome him back. David, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Always a pleasure, David.
It's always fun to be here.
And everybody, we hope to see you Monday night for Informal Paranormal at 10 p.m. Eastern, and then next week, Thursday, with Morgan Bell. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.
Good night.